talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
Good morning. It is June 28th.
And
this is June 27th, and this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Matz.
Lynn Van House.
Lynn Van House is sitting in today. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Tom. Hi,
thanks
Jim.
For joining us. Michelle is still out of town. Looks like she's going to be out of town for a long time, but she's not going to call in today either. So we are Michelle-less, but we are Lynn-full. And Lynn, of course, writes for the Belleville News Democrat and the Kirkwood Webster Times. And am I leaving anything out?
Y98.
Yeah. Oh, she reviews movie over. Is it Y98? When do you do that?
On Fridays at 6:10 with Paul Cook.
Fridays at 6:10. Listen to Lynn's reviews. What did you review this past Friday?
Free State of Jones.
Oh, yeah. We're going to all be reviewing that here in a few minutes. We got a lot to review. Holy cow. Free State of Jones, A Shallow, Art Bastard, Neon Demon, Independence Day, The BFG, De Palma, Our Kind of Traitor. Wow. I think a list of movies we don't have to review would be shorter. But let's start with the top 12. Michelle usually does this. Should we do this backwards?
I liked it backwards. Yeah. Didn't you?
When Michelle's not here, we do the top 12 backwards. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's very bold.
Shake it up.
Number 12 was Me Before You. I never saw it. Did you see that, Lynn?
No, I missed it.
Okay.
And I wanted to, but I don't know. Mixed reviews.
Yes.
Well, it's doing pretty good. It has legs.
And Michelle liked it. She saw it down in Texas.
That was my tasteless pun there.
It's from it is from a young adult novel.
Okay.
And it does have that Games of Thrones woman.
Okay. Yes, well, it made 1.9 million. Warcraft, which Jim loved.
Oh, people love to stomp on me about that.
Okay. Right. That made a massive 2.1 million. Was that about week number three?
So
it's dropped off the top 10, but it's number 11. Number 10 is Alice Through the Looking Glass.
I'm really surprised it's still up.
What is that still doing in the top 10? Yeah. What the heck?
That also made $2.1 million. Number 9 is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows. Did you see that, Lynn?
No, I missed it.
That made a whopping $2.4 million over the weekend. Number 8 is X-Men Apocalypse. Made 2.5. That's from 20th Century Fox. Let's see. Number 7, Now You See Me Too. I'm surprised that's still in the top 7.
Yeah.
I guess
You did not like it, did you?
I did not see it. Now You See
Me Too. I didn't
see
it either. I didn't like the first one, so I'm glad I did.
Yeah, it's like, this is getting a sequel. But we'll talk about unnecessary sequels much more.
Number 6 was Conjuring 2, which I gave a massive, what did I give it, 4 or 4.5 stars? That's
something
a really
like
good
that.
Scary
yeah.
horror film. That made 7.7 million. Free State of Jones in its opening weekend made 7.8. I don't think it cost a whole lot to make.
No,
maybe 60 or 70 million to make.
Yeah.
And we're going to review that here in a minute. Is that considered a disappointment, or about, you think that's about where
I
they...
I think that's in the middle of summer. That's pretty reasonable. Yeah,
historical drama.
But another movie that opened Friday and made twice as much money as Free State of Jones was The Shallows. It made $16.7 million. Probably a lot of that had to do with my very positive review over at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. I gave it 4.5 stars, and it made twice as much as Free State of Jones. Well, it made $16.7 million.
Well, that's because it's 45 minutes shorter than Free State of Jones, too.
And also, it has Blake Lively in
a bikini.
Bikini.
Yeah, and it only cost $17 million to make, so it's made super positive on that movie, and it's a very good movie. Central Intelligence with Kevin Hart and Dwayne Johnson was number 3 with $18.4 million, so it's still doing pretty well.
Surprising, yeah.
Independence Day Resurgence made $41.6 million. How much did that cost to make? Probably
at least $200 million, I'll bet you.
Opening weekend. Did you see that, Lynn?
No, they didn't screen it for us press folks.
Jim Linton saw it, so Jim's going to do a
solo. I spit the bullet last night and saw it on my own dime.
I'm going to go see it. My daughter Sarah wants to see it quite badly, but she's away at camp, so I have to wait till she gets back from camp.
Well, it'll be in the red box when she gets back.
No. It'll still be at theaters in 2 weeks. Good grief.
It'll be at the Keller, at least.
No, it'll be at the theaters in 2 weeks.
It'll be one screening a day.
Perhaps.
At 9 in the morning.
And then number 1 is Finding Dory.
Fun for the whole...
powering the sequel to number 1 spot with $102 million in 57 territories around the world. and combined with North America, topped the global chart with $143 million. So that 41 domestic is a little misleading. It actually made $143.7 million globally over the weekend.
Well, so it has a couple of international stars in it, so it's pandering to the international market. So that's one of the reasons why.
Yeah, that Judge Hirsch, he's really big in China.
No, that's not Judd.
On the animated side of life, Disney's Finding Dory continues to swim along and nears the 400 million mark in global waters. All right, and this weekend, what do we got? We got Tarzan. Is that open Friday, Tarzan?
Yes, okay. Legend of Tarzan.
Legend of
yes.
Tarzan opens Friday. That should do pretty good. Purge 3 will probably do pretty well. Probably didn't cost a whole lot to make.
Yeah.
And also Dave and Mike.
I think that's the week after.
Oh, it Dave is. And Mike, it is. We're just seeing it this week.
Okay, we're seeing that. Okay, that doesn't open. So Tarzan and Purge 3 will be perched, I should say, to try to knock off Dory out of the number one spot, but I don't think it's going to work.
Yeah.
Oh, no, the BFG opens Friday, too.
That's right.
The BFG. Spielberg. And Our Kind of Traitor opens in select theaters near you.
Select meaning very few, but you'll have to look for it.
That's right. BFG, I don't know if that's going to do all that well. It's going to be a little tough with Dory, and then you got Finding the Secret Lives of Pets the following weekend.
Yeah. I was going to say it'll just have a weekend or weekend to itself, 1 week to itself.
Yeah.
Spielberg and...
Yeah, it is, but
it's not a guarantee. That's for
sure. No, that's for sure. And, all right, we'll find out.
Because we're still waiting on that second Tintin movie, and that's not coming anytime soon. Right.
And we're still waiting on War Horse 2.
I think that was pretty much told. Yeah. They'll combine it with Warcraft.
All right, so that's the top 12.
Warcraft Horse.
We've got a lot of movies to review. Oh my gosh! Let's start with Free State of Jones.
He died with honor.
No, Will. He just died.
I'm tired of it.
You, me, all of us. We're all out there dying so they can stay rich.
Free State of Jones was number 5 with $7.8 million. They had a screening of it last Wednesday night, but they also had a screening of The Shallows. So I immediately chose The Shallows because I thought that would be better, and sounds like it was. Free State of Jones, Jim and Lynn both saw. Jim reviewed it at WeAreMovieGeeks.com.
No, I did not. Oh, Kate did.
Oh, Kate reviewed it. Yes. Did she give it a good review?
She got a fairly good review, yeah. Right. Yeah, she had a lot of problems with
it. All right. Well, Jim and Lynn, you both saw it, so why don't you guys start talking about Free State of Jones?
Ladies first here.
All right, well, it's a kumbaya movie. It's a big message movie, and it's a true story about the Civil Night. Matthew McConaughey in full savior mode.
Newt Knight.
And they fight the Confederacy.
Is this guy a real character?
Yes.
Is it a true story?
Yes. Yeah.
Newt Knight. And
because the Confederacy
is what sort of sidetracks the film every 20 minutes or so is they shoot ahead to an incident courtroom in 1940, or in the 1940s, and about a fellow being brought to or being sentenced for having black blood in him and marrying a white woman. And you're like, get back to Newt. You know, what are you doing? Really? And, you know, that could be another movie.
It takes you right out of it. It takes you out of it.
Who's in that? Those sections?
No one you've probably heard of.
But it's, you know, it's an A for a noble effort. It's very earnest, but it's a C for execution because it just goes on and on with sermons about equality. And McConaughey is in his intense mode. It's very intense. And it's a good cast, but it just goes on. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Every half hour he has to give some sort of speech in front of a bunch of people and convince them to do something. And I did learn a few things I didn't know. I didn't know about how, and if you had 20 more slaves, then your son would be exempt and so on and so forth. And a friend of mine explained, well, that was because they were so scared about the slaves uniting from the different plantations and revolting. So not only were they, you know, worried about that, of course, they were dealing with the Union Army and, you know, then they were starving, too. You know, they had their supplies cut off by the war. So, you know, the Confederacy, we're in it. What, she died with honor is what the one character keeps saying. It's like, honor's not going to keep you fed, you know?
Yeah. Well, the Knight character, he's just mad because he sees all this death and destruction and all these rich kids are getting out of the servant on the war.
I will say that first 20 minutes set on the battlefield is really great. I mean, if it could have been all about that, it would have been a much better film. Mm-hmm. But it just meanders. The whole thing with him taking on a black slave as his wife, who is played by, I'll let you pronounce her name.
Gugu Mbatha Raw.
Who we last saw in Concussion. But he had he was on the lam in the swamp because he ran when they came to his house, a house he was sharing with Kerry Russell, and he had a son, so he completely abandoned them. And then later on, those two come back, and everything seems to be fine with them. You know, it's very odd.
Well, she took off. She abandoned him, basically.
Well, he took off first, yeah.
And then the farmer house servant / slave, they can't marry. So they live together the rest of their lives, but they can't get married. But they have a son. Hmm. But the war action is very grisly and graphic. You know those first few minutes of Saving Private Ryan? It's like that, except medicine wasn't as advanced.
Yes,
and
yes.
So it's...
And there weren't pigs on the field rummaging through the corpses.
Yeah. So, all right. Sounds pretty good.
Well,
go see
it. If it were all that, yeah, but maybe 2.5 or 3.
All right. Lynn would give it a C, but an A for effort. All right, so Free State of Jones, mixed review over here at We Are Movie Geeks. Now we're going to move on to The Shallows.
It took forever to find, but... it's perfect.
What did you say the name of this place was?
This is paradise.
Jim and I saw The Shallow. Actually, I saw it at the screening last Wednesday, and I reviewed it for WeirdMovieGeeks.com. I gave it 4.5 stars. What a great little simple movie. There's not much to it. There's this woman, and she's 200 yards from shore, and there's a shark, and that's basically it. They do have, a little exposition at the very beginning. She's making a couple of phone calls to her little sister, and you find out that her mother had died of cancer, and that her mother, when she was pregnant with her, this beach that her mother had visited when she was pregnant, and she's with a traveling companion. But that traveling companion is back at the Hotel 6, so she's by herself, and she's surfing around. She meets a couple of other people, and then about the 25-minute mark, she gets bit on the leg by the shark.
It's because there's a big floating dead whale in the water, and she gets too close to that, and of course the shark is feeding on that.
Mm-hmm. She's on the whale battling off the shark, and then she makes it over to a little rock outcropping, and she's battling the shark there, and she sees a few people. There's this drunk Mexican guy passed out on the beach, so she screams at him. They can hear her screams, but what does he do to? He steals her purse, which is on the beach, and then foolishly wanders into the water to steal her surfboard as well. Big mistake. That scene really pushes the PG-13 gore level right there.
Yeah, this is
a rusty anchored buoy, and sort of the rest of the movie takes place on that thing. It's really intense, though, and this actress Blake Lively is really good. There's, like I said, there's not a whole lot to it. It's sort of simple and elemental and. Very intense.
It's a good B movie. I would say that.
It's a very solid action film.
It's not, as opposed to a lot of the stuff in the summer, it's not overstuffed with action as a certain other release is this weekend.
Right.
So
and
simple.
There's some dialogue. She's got this seagull that's perched on the rock with her, the seagull gets wounded as well. And she calls him, what you call him, Steven Seagull?
Yeah, it's Steven Seagull.
I was in my review, he sort of serves the same purpose that the volleyball in Castaway serves because she's talking to him. So you get some dialogue. And that's kind of a clever way to get some dialogue in there. I thought, what was that Robert Redford movie, Lost at Sea?
Yeah, this is a little bit of that. This is a little bit of 127 hours, one person against the elements.
Yeah, or Cujo. But she's talking, and that's okay. They do a pretty good job of that. She doesn't overdo it.
Well, she's in this hidden beach, and she has perfect cell reception on her phone. Absolutely no problem talking with anybody in the world, which is a little ludicrous to me, but I will forgive that.
She didn't have her cell phone when she was trapped by the shark.
Well, no, that was in her backpack. But when she's on the beach, she's talking with everybody. So,
is this the best shark movie since Jaws?
Oh, it's the best shark movie since Sharknado.
Well, definitely that. Maybe since Deep Blue Sea, I guess, was the one
Deep
with
Deep Blue Sea was pretty good. No, this is really a good movie.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd have to look at a list of shark movies to decide what it's better than. But it's certainly better than Jaws 3D.
Well, that's true. Jaws the Revenge.
Yeah.
Sam, Michael Caine was busy filming that instead of picking up his Oscar for Hannah and her sisters, for goodness sakes. So
I do highly recommend The Shallows. Let's move on. Lynn saw a documentary called Art Bastard.
Yes.
What's this Art Bastard about?
Well, it's about an artist in New York, and his name is Robert Cinadella. And he's 76 years old, and he's a big maverick in the art world. So you might not have heard of him, but when you see his art, you will know, because it's got a very distinct New York City metropolis flavor to it. And he's very whimsical, and then he has very much a twist to his art, and he takes on sarcastic political statements. And back in the 60s, he used to do some of those big message posters from the, you know, he had a Nixon target, and he also had an LBJ target that became very famous. Well, apparently he says what he thinks, and so he's rattled some cages in the art world, and he thinks that mediocrity shouldn't be determining who genius is.
As I say, he's got a problem with Pollock, as I recall, right?
He's got a Pollock with a lot of the darlings. He was a contemporary of Warhol's, so he's this great raconteur, and he has all these anecdotes, and it's just following him around New York, showing his art. He taught art, and it's a very fascinating film. I'd recommend it.
I read Kate's review, and that art looks really interesting. It's got a little whimsical, satirical look to it. It's almost like something that could have maybe been in Mad Magazine or something.
Where does the title Bastard come from?
Because he's a rebel. He's a maverick.
Okay.
Yes.
He's a bastard.
That's right. He's not conforming to the other art, people there.
But there's a good family twist story to it, too.
You want to give it away?
Oh, no.
He's the bastard child of 100 maniacs.
No, good reviewers don't give away things in their reviews.
I like spoiling.
Yes, you're outside the theaters yelling at the people.
Darth Vader is Luke's dad.
That's right. Leo buys it.
And Anthony Perkins is his own mother.
That's right.
It looks like a pretty good doc.
All right, well. Lynn recommends it. Another big movie that opened over the weekend was Independence Day Resurgence. They did not show it to us, though.
Oh, my God. A distress call.
Why are they screaming?
They're not screaming. They're celebrating.
They're coming back. It has its own gravity. What goes up must come down.
Shouldn't we be nervous?
Yeah.
Us being the critics, but yes, Jim went out and... Did you actually pay money to see this?
Yeah. I put slam my dime on the counter there and said, give me a ticket.
I made a measly $41.6 million, which has got to be a disappointment. Is it worth the money, Jim?
Oh, it's not. Barely worth a dime, I tell you. But, this is another in the category, I think we mentioned earlier, of sequels nobody asked for. And I'm sure people were clamoring for a sequel to Independence Day back in 1998 or 1999. But here we're 20 years later. And basically the world has changed according to the film. The film opens up with the ex-President Whitmore, played by Bill Pullman, and of course he's having nightmares about that fateful July 4th many years ago, and he believes that the aliens aren't done with Earth. And in the meantime, Celia Ward is now the president, and they show the new Washington, D.C. The world has been rebuilt, and we have used the alien technology that was left behind. So there's blue light, little helicopters without rotary blades, on this blue light power that we got from the aliens. And everything seems to be going along fairly well until... The different representatives there, the scientific community, starts getting some sort of broadcast from space. And it turns out that 20 years ago, when the big ship went down, a distress call went out. And it's taken a long time for them to respond, but it's finally gotten to them. They're coming back. And we get to meet Jeff Goldblum's character again. He's in Africa meeting up with a warlord that somehow has a psychic connection with the aliens, and he believes something weird is happening. Then we find out that President Whitmore's daughter, who's played by Micah Monroe, I believe is her name, who we saw in It Follows recently, is working for the new president as a speechwriter. And she's also an ex-pilot, as her father was, President Whitmore. And she is friends with Will Smith's character from the previous film, with his son, who's a fighter pilot, a pilot ace. He's the second generation they referred to in the film. He's played by Jesse Usher. But Micah is involved with a hotshot, sort of a maverick-type pilot played by Liam Hemsworth, the Hemsworth brother that's not Thor. So the one from The Hunger Games. And, there's the Liam is stationed on the moon, and there's some sort of alien craft coming towards there, and they blast at it and find it, but then another much bigger ship is coming, and it's crushing everything in its path, and it gloms on Earth and starts drilling. The purpose is to steal the molten core of the Earth, which the aliens use to power their home planet and, you know, make new technology. And this, a lot of battles ensue. For some reason, Charlotte Gainsborough, the French actress, is in this, playing a contemporary of Jeff Goldblum's and a possible love interest. And, boy, this thing just has the
subplots. That's weird casting.
Yeah. And she's talking with sort of a British accent in it, too. So it's very odd. And, you know, lots of subplots. The Brent Spiner character from the first film comes out of his coma, and he's jumping around and, you know, trying to get things going. And he's another failed attempt at a humorous subplot at comic relief in the film. There's a bureaucrat that keeps popping up, and nothing he does is funny, but everything stops. He's like the Jar Jar Binks of this movie.
But cut to the chase. How is Judd Hirsch?
Judd Hirsch is trying to live off his fame from 20 years ago. He's peddling a book at different senior senators, How I Save the World. And for some reason, he's got his own boat, and he gets out of the boat, and he hooks up with a school bus, so he's driving a school bus that's being pursued by the aliens, and it's just so ridiculous. And you think the film is over, and it keeps on going and going, and at the end of it, it's going, hey, we're going to go get him. Well, let's do a sequel.
But nobody's going to see this for the story. How is the disaster porn?
It's there. It's nothing much different than what we saw in the first film. You know, lots of things crumbling. Now a lot of stuff floats up in the air and then gets dropped on top of other things. And it's just long and, you know, just a tedious slog.
Okay, so Jim does not recommend Independence Day, although it's not getting bad reviews across the board. Stephen Trodenchek reviewed it for WeAreMovieGeeks.com. I gave it 4 out of 5 stars. I think it's right around 50% over on
it's about 34 or something.
Is it down there?
Yeah. Miracle of Miracles is in the double digits. I'm really surprised, because it's really, it's the second summer in a row that that Fox has had a big sci-fi bomb. It's certainly better than Fantastic Four last year, but not a whole lot.
Was it better than 2010?
2012? Or
2010? Well, 2010 is the sequel of 2001.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
2012. I love 2012.
Was the Devlin Emmerich film that had John Cusack
in it.
Yeah,
that was great.
Yeah. It's certainly better than Stonewall. That was Emmerich's last film. But I don't think it's as entertaining as White House Down, because I think White House Down kind of knew it was silly. And this one is trying to take itself too seriously, and it's just ridiculous.
All right, so Jim does not recommend Independence Day. Speaking of silly, Jim and I saw Neon Demon Saturday night. Neon Demon is a new film from Nicholas Winding Refn. And it stars Ellie Fanning as a 16-year-old orphan who heads to L.A. to become a fashion model.
And you know, that always turns out well.
Yeah. He's taken under the wing of Jenna Malone, who is a makeup artist who puts makeup on corpses at night and does other things with corpses, which we won't go into. And she also hooks up with a couple of other fashion models played by Bella Heathcote and Abby Lee. Bella Heathcote is sort of obsessed with plastic surgery, and all she talks about is all the things she's had done to her face.
You might remember her from the Dark Shadows movie a couple years ago.
And you might remember Abby Lee from Mad Max last year.
She was one of the brides.
She was one of the breeders, yes. And both of those actresses are actually quite good in this movie. They're kind of creepy and scary.
Yeah, they're kind of doing this passive aggressive bullying thing with Ellie Fanning's character. It's very strange.
So Ellie Fanning plays Jessie, and then she's finds quite a bit of success right off the bat. She sort of becomes the hot new thing. All the photographers want to take pictures of her, which doesn't sit too well with some of the more established fashion models. And then it just kind of gets weird. She's staying in this sort of seedy motel run by Keanu Reeves, and those scenes are really, really good. And there's even a scene where she goes to her hotel. There's something in her motel room, and that scene is handled really well. Keanu Reeves is really good in this sort of sleazy, gruff role.
Oh, he's creepy in it. Yeah, man, yeah.
But those scenes are sort of at odds with all the modeling scenes, which are filmed in sort of a surreal, sort of fetishistic way, with women looking in the mirrors constantly, and it's very colorful. And it's very bold and sort of audacious, and it's sort of crazy. I really like this movie a lot. I'm not sure if it quite sustains its weirdness for its entire 2 hours. About, maybe at this 75 or 80 minute mark, I was like, oh, I get it. But then it gets kind of gross, which is a little surprising. It gets into some things with necrophilia and cannibalism. Not that I'm giving anything away. But there's, vomiting of body parts and things like that, which are going to turn off a lot of people. But I really like this film quite a bit. Nicholas Winding Refn, of course, did Drive a couple years ago.
With Ryan Gosling.
That was really a masterpiece.
Fantastic.
This isn't nearly as good as that. He also did Only God Forgives, which this is a little better than that. Although that was good, too.
That was booed off.
Understandably. Young movie geeks are really going nuts over this Neon Demon, and it is really good. I would give it maybe 4 out of 5 stars. What do you think, Jim?
I'd give it maybe 1.
Oh, you didn't like it?
No, not at all. I couldn't wait for it to end. It was just weird for weird's sakes. It was just trying to be shocking.
That's okay.
And it was just tedious. And, I get the point, that these young women are eaten alive by the modeling industry, that they worship youth. And you could have done that in a 10-minute short. And it's just stretched on and on and on. And it's trying to shock. And I felt bad for some of the actresses in it, having to humiliate themselves in different sequences, and especially Jenna Malone. I felt really bad because she's a talented young actress. But boy, this is just a mess, just artsy schmartsy to the max.
Yeah, the scene in the funeral home with Jenna Malone and a recently deceased woman was just pretty darn creepy, even by my standards. I can usually handle that kind of stuff, but that one was making me squirm.
Yeah, well, yeah. Do you think that's the reason that they didn't have a critic screening for it?
Oh, one of the many, I'm sure.
I don't know. I liked the movie. I thought it was a really good movie.
Well, that his last film only played in one theater here in town. Yeah. At least this is in about 6 theaters. When we saw it, I think there were
6 or 7 people
six
there.
Six of us in there, for a Saturday night screening at 9:30. Mm-hmm. So if you're wanting to see it in the theater, I would say try to see it in the next few days, because they're going to yank it or put it down to one showing a day very, very soon. Mm-hmm. So,
all right, let's move on. We've still got 3 movies to review. Oh, my gosh. Lynn saw something called Our Kind of Traitor. What is that about, Lynn?
Well, it's from a 2010 John Le Carré movie. And speaking of the film Drive, the screenwriter for that, Hossein Amini, is the screenwriter for this one. So they take this Le Carré spy novel, and this time it's not the smiley character that Gary Oldman played in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. It's an ordinary couple played by the always wonderful Ewan McGregor, and his /girlfriend/wife is Naomi Harris.
Naomi Harris?
And they're on holiday because he's a poetry professor, but he had a thing with a student, so she's not trusting him. So they're trying to repair their relationship. So they're in Marrakesh, and they meet this big, flamboyant Russian played by Stellan Skarsgård named Dima, and he tells them he's a money launderer for the Russian mafia. And now the latest trend in movies is that all bad guys are Russian mafia. And so he gives them a little disc to give to the British Secret Service in helping him, because he doesn't like what's going on with the head guy. He got some ties to the British government that he wants to expose. So they're all of a sudden thrust into this espionage tale and very taut thriller. Okay. I was impressed.
Well, we saw that. Did we see the trailer for that with the Neon Demon?
I don't think so.
Okay, maybe I saw it with another one of the films I saw last night. They're all mixing together, but it looked very interesting. And what is the actor's name? Is Jason Isaacs? Is that his name from Homeland?
Damian Lewis.
Damian Lewis. I confuse those two actors all the time.
Yes, and he's very good as the British Secret Service contact they have. And it's very well done. It's directed by a woman named Susanna White, And she's done a lot of the British miniseries on TV, like Jane Eyre, and she's been nominated for Emmys. And she's done some of the HBO series like Games of Thrones and or is it Game of Thrones?
Well, yeah, Damien kind of resembles he's in the running to play James Bond along with several other actors right now. But he kind of resembles Michael Caine as in Harry Palmer in the 60s spy thrillers.
He does. Mm. And it's good. I don't know about you guys how you are about Le Carre novels, but I've not read them. I did love the movie The Constant Gardener, and that's one of his books. So I think this is on par with one of his finest thrillers. And it has a lot of Hitchcockian elements to it. It's set in the Swiss Alps at some point, which is really cool.
Well, you know, I liked the Tinker Tailor adaptation a few years ago with Gary Oldman, so I'd like to check that out sometime.
So Lynn recommends Our Kind of Traitor, which opens Friday, probably over at the Landmark Theaters.
Actually, it's going to be at High Point.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay.
And Ronnie's and Chesterfield Galaxy.
Oh, yes.
Well, go to the High Point and see it then.
And Landmark, too.
Oh, yes.
All right, let's move along. Jim and I saw Steven Spielberg's new movie, which opens this Friday, is called The BFG. That BFG stands for Big Friendly Giant.
So and
the
just
big
get friendly that other thought out of your head right now.
Why did you take me?
Because I hears your lonely heart. I hear in all the secret whisperings of the world.
BFG is played by Mark Rylance, who just won the Oscar recently for the last Steven Spielberg movie, so he's on a roll as Mr. Spielberg. Did the giant have a name, or is it just BFG his name?
I think that was it, pretty much, yeah.
And it takes place, I think, in the 1980s.
Oh,
and,
yes. Well, at the start of it, I thought it was set in the 40s or 50s, but then they drop a couple of references in the last third of the film.
Yeah.
It's in the 80s, yeah.
Right.
Well, it's from that Roald Dahl book.
Roald Dahl, that's right.
It's
about this little, do we know that little actress?
Yes. Her name, she plays Sophie, is Ruby Barnhill.
Okay.
And this is her screen debut.
Yeah, and she's in like every scene, so she has quite the burden on her shoulders. She is in an orphanage, and the big F giant reaches in and grabs her one night because she has insomnia and can't sleep. So if you see the giant, then he has to grab you, apparently, according to the rules of this movie. And he takes her over to Giant Land and his lair, and he's real friendly to her and feeds her, what do they call it, schnozcumbers,
because
that's the only food that the giants have to eat, except the other giants that are living outside, they have all kinds of nicknames, mostly involving eating humans.
Yeah, blood splatterer and things like that, and you know, but yeah, that the head of those giants is voiced by Jermaine Clement.
The Flight of the Conchords.
Yeah,
I thought it was Sacha Baron Cohen for most of the film.
I thought it was Daniel Craig actually. I was trying to figure out who it was.
I'm seeing this tomorrow night.
Well, we don't want to give too much away. Except I don't think it's very good. There's all this stuff that goes on and on in the first half, especially where the giant is. What does he do? He collects dreams.
Yeah, so that's where it kind of goes off the rails.
Oh, the dream. It's very Spielberg-esque. Dreams are like these fireflies, and he's running around capturing these dreams in these jars, and he's collecting them, and that's not very good. And the BF giant actually has a lot of personality. Mark Rylance is very good, but the other giants really aren't given much to do. The villain giant is okay, but then there's it's 8 or 10 other giants, and they just look like cartoons. They're not given distinctive personalities. It's really inert and just kind of sits there, and I was really bored until about maybe the 75-minute mark. They go to Buckingham Palace and they visit the Queen of England. Then it sort of gets a little more interesting. Rebecca Hall shows up and Rafe Spall, and there are a couple of good actors that I like, and they're really good.
And Penelope Wilton is very good as the Queen.
Is she
too?
Okay?
Yes.
I didn't know who that actress was.
Yes.
Well, is it all CGI?
No. It's motion capture for the giants themselves. So I saw some behind-the-scenes footage, and Rylance has the little dots on his face, so it's similar to what they did with the new Planet of the Apes films, or Gollum, or some characters like that.
Yeah. And the scene at the Buckingham Palace is sort of fun, and it ends with them drinking this potion. I don't want to give it away, but I'm going to give it away anyway. Well, and they all fart. So everybody's farting this, and with green gas coming out of their butts. And there's these dogs flying through the air with green gas coming out of their butts. And the audience was just rolling on the floor during that sequence. Of course, farting dogs is funny, but it's a little sad that it's the highlight of a Steven Spielberg movie. Good grief! I haven't been this bored at a Spielberg movie since Hook, and that was like 25 years ago. I don't know if it's going to do very well. I have the feeling that BFG might be a BFG bomb.
Yeah, I will disagree with you a little bit. I think that the first 15 minutes is pretty riveting when you're introduced to Sophie and the giant. He's showing her around his place and all that, and that's kind of interesting. But as you say, he gets into the collecting dream stuff, and they go to a dream tree, and it just meanders, and the little girl is trying to hide from the other giants, and that just seems to go on and on. And then it kicks into high gear when they get back to the palace.
Yeah.
But there's about, a middle 45 minutes or so that where it just seems like nothing's happening.
Mm-hmm. So a mixed review from us.
Well, what about the action? Because a lot of times Dahl takes on awful adults as his target.
It's funny. Last night I went and saw Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, which is, of course, based on a Roald Dahl book. I saw it at the AMC Chesterfield as part of the Fathom events, and I was just, it's amazing how, subversive and funny and edgy that film is, even though it's 45 years old, compared to this sort of safe, family-friendly BFG.
Yeah, it's a little too whimsical at times. Yes,
but forced whimsy.
Yeah.
Spielberg is often guilty of.
Well, I like when Dahl has that edge.
Oh, yeah. I would have liked to see more of that.
Because Matilda
in the
has that edge.
The witches.
James and the Giant Peach.
Yeah.
I mean, there are hints. We never get to see the other giants doing horrible things, but we're kind of told that. That's why the queen is involved.
Yeah, and then the queen sends her helicopters and her army to capture all the big giants, and that sequence lasts, 5 minutes?
Yeah,
it should have been the centerpiece of the film.
Those giants are dispatched very quickly.
Yeah. All right, so mostly negative review from us for the BFG. Okay, we're seeing a couple movies this week. Swiss Army Man we're seeing this afternoon.
I needed you to help me get home. Okay, buddy?
Okay, buddy.
Daniel Radcliffe being radical again.
Paul Dano.
Daniels brothers, almost. Well, not they're not brothers.
They're not brothers.
Dan Kwan and Daniel Scheinert.
All right, so we'll review that next week. And we're also seeing today, or tonight, I should say, Tarzan. What's the full title?
The Legend of Tarzan.
The Legend of Tarzan.
You are Tarzan.
You may not like who you were. You may have enemies there, but you need to go home.
With Alexander Skarsgård in a six-pack.
I hope it's better than The Legend of the Lone Ranger.
Oh, so do I.
And Margot Robbie apparently is the female lead in this.
And Christoph Waltz is the villain.
And Samuel L. Jackson is playing a character based on a real person, I heard. It'll be interesting. Yeah.
All right, so we'll have a review of that next week as well. And then tomorrow night we're seeing Purge 3 Election Year. I'll be reviewing that for WeirdMovieGeeks.com. That is a sequel to, or the third in the Purge series, I should say. Ouch.
This July, have your voice be heard.
I purged.
Show your support.
I purged because it's my civic duty.
For the Purge.
I purged because staying in is an American.
Yeah, all by the same director, this James DeMonaco.
All right. I didn't care for the first one. The second one's a little better. This new one looks really silly, but we'll see. Look for my review. And then I guess Wednesday night we're seeing Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates.
Mom and Dad, what's going on here?
Over the years at our family gathering, you two show up and you ruin it. I want you to bring a date to your sister's wedding. We don't want you showing up stag and riling each other up.
We don't rile each other up.
We never get riled up.
Yes.
That looks kind of hyperactive.
Yeah, directed by Jake Szymanski.
Week from Thursday, I'm hosting a screening of The Last Man on Earth, starring St. Louis's own Vincent Price. And that'll be over at Schlafly Bottle Works. That is a
good
fundraiser for helping kids together. And I will have Vincent Price trivia and some nice Vincent Price prizes.
And
I'm auctioning off a couple of pieces that were in the Vincent Price exhibit that was part of.
Yeah, what's the date again on that?
That'll be next Thursday, which I believe is the 7th.
Yes, good.
And then, of course, my 16mm night is next Tuesday. I'll be showing The Day the Earth Stood Still, double feature with Richard Pryor live on the Sunset Strip, and that is at the Way Out Club starting at 8 o'clock. That is a free event, although we will be setting out a jar for the National Children's Cancer Society.
It's quite the
double feature.
Yes, the theme is there is no theme. Let's see. Jim saw a movie in Chicago last weekend that opens this Friday in St. Louis called De Palma.
Being a director is being a watcher. You have a lot of egos in the room, and you have to sort of watch how they interact with each other. There was Marty and I, then there was George and Francis and Steven.
Oh, yes.
De Palma is a documentary about the great director Brian De Palma.
Yeah, I was on vacation in Chicago. What do I do on vacation? I go see a movie.
That's what I do on vacation.
Me too.
Saw it at the Fabulous Music Box Theater. And yeah, this is a documentary about Brian De Palma. It is directed by Noah Baumbach and Jake Paltrow. Oh, yeah. And in some of the reviews I've read, he said it's no great shakes as a documentary because basically they just placed a camera on Brian, set him in front of a dark blue fireplace, and just let him talk about his film career. But it is fascinating. I saw a lot of clips I'd never seen before. We delve right into his going right from high school into film school. A lot of his student films, a lot of his early things. There was a film having to do with the god Wotan that stars William Finley, who later on was in several of the features that Brian directed.
Mm-hmm. He was the Phantom of the Paradise.
That's right. And it is just fascinating. He goes through he gave Robert De Niro his first feature film job in The Wedding Party, and you see De Niro as a fresh faced young lad in a couple of black and white features, and then it goes into his actual feature films that we'd seen in theaters. Like, Get to Know Your Rabbit, I guess, is maybe the first one.
That's the only one I haven't seen.
Yeah, Tommy Smothers, film.
Actually, Greetings and Hi Mom and The Wedding Party were all shot back-to-back, and they all featured Robert De Niro.
And Murder a la Mod, which I had heard of.
William Finley. I've got that on the Something Weird label. That's really good.
Yeah, plus they show a PBS-style documentary he did about modern art, a black and white doc. That's kind of interesting. But yeah, Get to Know Your Rabbit, great story there about making Orson Welles learn his lines that drove Brian crazy, going over his stuff in his dressing room. And then Sisters follows that fairly soon, and then Phantom of the Paradise, and then he struck gold with, Obsession was before that, before Carrie, but then Carrie
was his biggest. That's what put him on the map, definitely.
Yeah.
And then when Carrie came out, and then, there was a couple of others right after that, Dressed to Kill. But they reissued Greetings and Hi Mom. They would play that double feature at the Tivoli back in the late 70s when De Palma was super hot. So I went and saw those. Those were made in the real early 70s, or maybe even late 60s.
Yeah, I think the late 60s. Yeah. And it talks about his highs and lows, and he even mentions they do cover Bonfire of the Vanities. He mentions the great book The Devil's Candy. I think it's the writer is Julie Solomon, and he says she pretty much got everything right on that one. And then you get his triumphs, like The Untouchables. And you even get his Bruce Springsteen music video, Dancing in the Dark. He talks about that. And it turns out that Eichmann talks about some of his later films, which I wasn't aware of. One that came out, I guess, most recently was Passion,
Passion was a remake of a French film that starred Kristin Scott Thomas that I reviewed over at We Are Movie Geeks. I can't think of the name of the French version, actually. But it's pretty good. But that never played theatrically, the remake, Passion.
I want to say the other one is Redacted, is that
Redacted
right?
Redacted did play for a week over at the Galleria. That's a anti-Iraq war film. It's not very good. It's not very subtle either. The main villain's name is Rush. That's how subtle that film is. But it really, really bombed. I think it made $35,000.
Black Dahlia really bombed.
Oh, that's a stinkeroo, man.
That's one of his lesser efforts. But even that's visually interesting.
Yeah. So it's great to hear him. You might have heard a lot of these stories before, but to hear him directly from the man himself is really fascinating. A lot of stuff about the film guys he sort of went to school with and kind of sort of came up through the ranks at the same time. Stories about Scorsese and Coppola and Lucas and Spielberg. And You get to see that audition footage because I think they were casting Carrie and Star Wars like in the same little casting area. And so you see the grainy old black and white videotape. And it's funny, and when he talks about Carrie, you get to see small clips from the different reboots and sequels and remakes. And there's even a small segment from the Carrie stage musical in there. So it's a really entertaining film. And for a film fan, it's just pure heaven. You know, really fascinating. And I'll be interested to hear what you think of the ending. I have a couple of different interpretations about it. But I think it's open for discussion. I think it's the film itself is well worth seeing for anyone who loves film. So I would, if I were reviewing it, I don't know if I'm going to be reviewing it or not at the end of the week, but we'll see. But I would give it the 5 stars. I think it's great.
Good. But that kind of makes us think about Brian De Palma and his career. He's one director I've seen almost everything he's made. I mentioned I had never seen this Rabbit, Get to Know Your Rabbit movie, but I've seen pretty much all his other films. No, I've never seen Home Movies. I think Kirk Douglas is in there.
Yes, he is, and Nancy Allen. And was it Gordon is his name?
Gordon? Scott Gordon.
Or Seth Gordon or something like that?
Yeah,
who's the star of Dressed to Kill, yeah. Yeah, they have some grainy videotape footage from that film in this documentary.
I don't think that played theatrically, at least not in St. Louis.
Well, you know, his wife, Nancy Allen, who he was married to for 5 years, she won the Razzie for actress, Worst Actress, and a Golden Globe nomination for one of my favorites, Blowout.
Oh, I
find that hilarious. The same year, she was nominated for Golden Globe, and she won the Razzie.
Oh, not the only actress that's happened with, that's for sure.
No,
Sandra Bullock, anyone?
Yeah. Has anyone tried to watch Scarface recently?
No, I'm not a fan.
Oh, I hadn't seen that in 20 years. I remember when that came out in 83. That was like the coolest movie to see. I love that.
Yeah, he's sort of perplexed by how the film has been embraced by the hip-hop and rap community. He's like, really?
You know,
it's not very good.
Oh, no.
It,
but
it's
you
aged
know.
Horribly. The acting is terrible. The action sequences are
The
shot.
Dialogue. Oh, my God.
Oh.
But a fun fact, the group Blink-182 gets their name, their number, from the amount of F-words in Scarface, 182, FYI.
Well, Brian talks quite a bit about that, the final shootout, about how you had to shoot around Al Pacino, who got injured on the set. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Let's talk about our very favorite Brian De Palma movies. How many do we want to pick? 3?
Three's a good number.
All right, 3. We're going to go around the table, and we're going to talk about our 3 favorite Brian De Palma movies. Lynn, what's your number 3 favorite Brian De Palma movie?
That would be The Untouchables.
Yeah.
1987. I thought it was a really fun, big...
It is a great film.
...movie with a great cast.
Yes, yes.
And Andy Garcia was...
Yeah,
you
Sean
know,
Connery won the Oscar for that.
And Patricia Clarkson was Elliot Ness's wife.
Yeah, and Billy Drago was Frank Vitti.
Yeah,
Nitti, I should say.
Yeah, Frank Vitti.
Jim, what's your number 3 Brian De Palma film?
My number 3 is Dressed to Kill. I know it's some folks find it distasteful, but boy, that the whole sequence in the art gallery is just mesmerizing filmmaking. It's just fantastic.
The beginning is fabulous.
Yeah. And Brian has a great story about that, about how the Gordon character in it, the young son character, is pretty much him.
Keith Gordon,
that's right.
I said
Keith
Scott
Gordon.
Earlier.
And I thought Seth.
You
but
guys
Keith.
Said, yeah.
So Jim
and
likes,
Angie Dickinson.
Dressed to Kill. Yeah, my number 3 is Sisters. That was one of his early horror films.
Oh, yeah.
Margot
really
Kidder.
Yeah, and William Finley is the mad scientist. And Jennifer Salt is this woman who's trying to solve this mystery of this weird neighbor who she thinks she's seen a murder, which is, of course, very Hitchcockian.
And great Bernard Herrmann score.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Brian has some great stories about him.
Oh, yeah. And that's a really scary, gory horror film from the 70s. I remember seeing that on television when I was like 9 and kind of being blown away by it. Let's go to number 2. Lynn, what's your number 2 favorite Brian De Palma movie?
That would be Blowout, 1981. I just love this movie, and I think it is one of those movies that was ignored when it came out, but it has gained cult classic status. Vilmos Siegman did a fabulous job with the cinematography, but it's got the, you know, it's the thriller with the political overtones, and John Travolta in a really good film at the time of his, you know, this was post-Grease.
Nancy Allen was in that as well.
Yes.
And she was married to De Palma at the time, I believe.
Right, and John Lithgow, who is one of his favorite go-to villains.
Oh, yeah, lots
and,
of good stuff.
Dennis Franz was a villain in that one.
Yes, he's used Dennis Franz a couple times.
Yeah, I remember Saturday Night Live did a scathing movie parody. It was a remake of The Birds, and it said, every year, Brian De Palma ravages the corpse of a famous director and gives his wife a job. Like, oh, my gosh.
She wasn't a very good actress.
She's my Facebook friend, by the way.
Oh, my goodness.
So you tell
gracious.
Her what Lynn said.
Okay, well,
probably listens to our podcast.
Yeah.
All right, Jim, what's your number two favorite Brian De Palma movie?
Well, I tell you, when you've got a taste for terror, take Carrie to the prom.
There you go.
Yeah, Carrie. One of my top one or two Stephen King film adaptations, just fantastic beginning to end. No wonder Sissy Spacek and Piper Laurie were nominated for Oscars for it. Fantastic film, incredible sequence at the end, and they've tried to remake it, and nothing compares to that '76 original.
And Nancy Allen and John Travolta in that one as well.
PJ Souls and William Catt, just fantastic.
Yeah. My number two will be The Untouchables, which Lynn had as her number three. That's such a great movie. I watched it many, many times. What can you say about The Untouchables? Great score, great Kevin Costner performance, great Sean Connery. I love The Untouchables. But now that brings us down to number one. Lynn, what's your favorite? Number one favorite Brian De Palma film?
I have to go with Carrie.
Yeah.
She just, if you watch it again, Sissy Spacek just breaks your heart.
Amazing, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's so good. It's so well done. And like you said, Jim, it still holds up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. The remakes just don't come close to it. Yeah, they have a clip of Chloe Moretz Grace from the remake floating towards the camera during the prom scene. It's like, it's, you know, ridiculous.
Oh, that, yeah, like you said.
The remake was terrible, but it wasn't anywhere near as good as the prom.
But the first cast of Carrie was just terrific. Amy Irving.
Well, yeah.
Betty Buckley.
Yeah, that's just fantastic, yeah. Well, my number one is The Untouchables. My gosh, that Ennio Morricone score I could listen to forever.
Yes.
The fabulous period costumes. Actually, I was living in Chicago when they were filming that. I went down to the train station to pick up a friend of mine, and we saw the lights up, and we asked the guys that were guarding them. I said, what's going on? I said, at night we're going to be shooting a movie. So we went down there, and we were there when they were shooting the big baby on the steps sequence,
Potemkin.
I remember I was with a crowd of people watching, and we saw Kevin Costner walking around in costume, and somebody in the crowd said, who's that? I said, Kevin Costner. And they said, who's that? And I went to, it was Silverado, American Eagles, and they didn't know who he was.
And No Way Out.
And after Untouchables, everybody knew who Kevin Costner was.
Okay. Yeah, they put him on the map. No, definitely. It is a fabulous film.
And my number one is Carrie. There we go. I saw Carrie opening night at the Webster Grove Cinemas, double feature with Demon Seed with Julie Christie. And I didn't know who Brian De Palma was at the time, and he immediately became one of my very favorite directors. Oh, yeah, Carrie was just the horror movie that we needed in 1976.
And how crazy did the audience go at the very end of the movie?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was amazing.
Oh, well, I had seen Obsession before Carrie, so I knew.
I had seen Phantom of the Paradise. I just wasn't placing this director as being the same director as these two.
I would like to mention Carlito's Way as the fourth one, because if you look at that work, and that Pacino is back on track, Sean Penn's fabulous.
Yeah. And another great, more recent one was Femme Fatale with Rebecca Romijn. That's an amazing Brian De Palma. Have you seen that one?
No.
I have to put it on the list.
I've got it on DVD if you'd like to borrow it.
Okay.
All right, so we really love Brian De Palma. Who doesn't love Brian De Palma? And we're going to love this documentary that opens Friday. Jim's already seen it. And a couple other things we want to talk about, because we got another minute and a half. Be sure to go check out my interview I did with Paul Talbot. Paul Talbot is the author of my favorite movie book of last year. It's called Bronson's Loose Again, On the Set with Charles Bronson. And Paul really focused on movies that Charles Bronson had starred in after Death Wish, and which was really smart, because a lot of books about Bronson were written in the mid-70s, and then Paul picks up after that and interviews a key figure from each and every one of these post-Death Wish Charles Bronson films. So I did a rather in-depth interview with Paul. It's about a 5,000-word article. I posted it last night at We Are Movie Geeks, so go check that out. And Jim wants to wish happy birthday to one of his favorite people in the world, and that would be...
That would be my favorite EGOT, Mel, I love your face, Brooks. Oh, you're a great guy.
And he's 90?
He is going to be 90 years old tomorrow, Tuesday the 28th. It should be a national holiday.
It should be.
Because he's a national treasure. God bless him. He's a World War II vet. He's just a fabulous guy.
He's still working, I guess.
Yeah. You still see him pop up. He was a voice on the recent Hotel Transylvania 2. He's just a fantastic performer, director, writer, everything.
All right, real quick, what's your favorite Mel Brooks movie?
Oh, Young Frankenstein. I could watch every day.
What's your favorite Mel Brooks movie, Lynn?
The Original Producers.
And mine, I would have to say, is Blazing Saddles. So we each have a different one. They're all three great movies, and Mel Brooks is a great, funny man. We got to wrap this up, though. Next week, we'll be back with reviews of Swiss Army Man, The Legend of Tarzan, Purge 3, Election Year, and Dave and Mike Need Wedding Dates. But for now, we're going to have to sign off. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Betts.
Lynn Venhoff.
Thanks for joining us, Lynn.
Thank you for having me.
And tune in again next week.
Black leather, black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, black leather, ta-ta-ta. Black leather, black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather, rock.